Do you remember Dr. Seuss? He's got movies on the loose. His heirs are raking in the cash, even if the films are trash. Some okay and others bad. Most will bore your mom and dad. But Horton's flick is kind of fun, and it went to number one.
The number one movie in America.
The number one movie in America.
Bravo.
Oh, thanks.
That was amazing. Thank you.
The rhythm is the tricky, you know. Yeah, the rhyme fine, but then you gotta work around that kind of Seussian.
Loved it.
Thank you. And number one movie in America. I'm Sean Collier. I am joined by, what did we even talk about last week? Oh, yeah. I'm joined by two lost toys. It's Camila Adams.
You're my favorite deputy.
And Robin Hitchcock.
There's a snake in my boot.
See?
That's what you're going to say in my pants.
But again, nobody wanted to be Buzz because Buzz is useless.
Yeah.
Anyway, we're thinking about our relationship with patron Saint Tony Goldwyn, who guides our invisible hand all wrong. Tony is not here to give us good movies. Sometimes he does, like as a treat, but he's here to illustrate something. Okay. And last week we spent a lot of time on the death of the G rating. Mm-hmm. And Tony decided to give us a G-rated movie that actually should have been a G-rated movie in return. So here we are with Horton.
Like, you know what, kids? Here you go.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Thanks, I guess, Tony.
Yeah.
And it wasn't a bad time. You know, if you ask me in 3 weeks if I've ever seen Horton Hears a Who, I'm probably going to go, I don't think so.
If you ask me in 3 days, I might not know.
Yeah,
it took me about 4 days to get through this movie.
And it's an hour and 20 minutes long.
I know it exactly. And it doesn't make any sense.
I watched the original Horton Hears a Who TV special from 1970, which is no Grinch Stole Christmas on the, you know, Seuss adaptations meter. But that is about 26 minutes. And it also dragged. There's just no story here. Like, nothing happens.
Yeah. Book.
Yeah, I don't even think I've ever read. I never even read the book. Like, I'm familiar with the title of Horton Hears a Who, but I was never sure. I never knew what the story was. And I like Dr. Seuss books. I had, like, a bunch growing up, and Horton was never one of them.
So, in order to stretch this out into alleged feature length, they did a deeper dive into Whoville. Or I don't know if they actually call it Whoville in this, do they?
They do, yeah.
Okay. In the book, he talks to the mayor, and we see them try to make noise, but it's not, like, the whole, like, backstory and the complicated monarchy involved with their mayor.
It was unnecessary.
That was invented.
It's a hereditary mayorship. Like, man, that's... I mean, we know bad political systems.
Right.
That's a bad political
right.
system.
Well, it reminds me, it's like the opposite of how... I can't remember her character's name. Natalie Portman in the Star Wars prequels is an elected queen.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Oh, really? Huh.
Yeah, she's elected. It might be her position in the Senate that's elected, and she's genetically a queen, but it sounds like she's an elected queen. I don't know. Star Wars dorks, sound off on Twitter. Let us know.
By which we mean continue sounding off on Twitter,
because
that's all you ever do.
Sound off directly towards us.
Well, since Robin brought up the question of what happens in this movie, what happens in this movie? To answer that question, here's Camila with this week's 60-second recap of Horton Hears a Who.
Okay, so Horton is an elephant who hears people on a speck that floats by. He saves the speck and puts it on a flower, but there's the kangaroo mom who doesn't like fun, so she tells Horton to shut up about it. He doesn't, and then there's a whole world of people called Who's Living on the Speck. The mayor of Whoville and Horton start to talk. Then the mayor is scared because his world is in trouble. He tries to tell everybody, but no one believes him. The mayor and Horton try to save Whoville, but the mean kangaroo sends a big scary bird to eat the speck. The mayor tries to get Horton to talk to everybody, but the big scary bird flies away with the flower. Everyone laughs at the mayor, and that makes him sad. So now Whoville is dark and windy, and the big bird drops the flower in a field with like a bazillion flowers that looks just like it. And it takes Horton forever to find his flower. Then he finds it, and the Whos can hear him, and they believe him. And then the kangaroo gets really mad and brings everyone to tie up Horton and put him in a cage. The bear's son, Jojo, saves the day by yelling at a thing so everyone can hear him. Then the animals stop being mad at Horton, and everyone is happy. What's a boob? Okay, bye.
That's exactly what children sound like. Penny Arcade used to do, Penny Arcade is Arcade Comedy Theater's family-friendly children's show, and they used to do a thing where they'd have a kid summarize the plot of a story they like, and it was my favorite thing was the kid summarizing the plot of the story. Going back to Star Wars, there was one time a kid was talking about Star Wars, and he called the Millennium Falcon Lemmy Falcon. That was beautiful, Camila. Also, I wasn't paying attention to time because I was so entranced. Did she get it?
55 seconds.
Okay. Yes! I always get so nervous when I do those things that I always end up like running out of breath. I forget to breathe.
Apparently, it's gimmick week because I rhymed the top and right. Camila took off the character. Robin, what do you have to liven up?
I have a backstory.
Okay, that's good.
Yeah. So Cinco Paul and Ken Daria wrote this. I have met Cinco Paul because they both wrote Bubble Boy and Bubble Boy the Musical, which Arcade Comedy Theater put on last year. Mm-hmm. And Cinco Paul came to see the show, and he's very tall and very nice. But also, I wanted to talk about the messaging of this, and like my main beef with this forgettable movie is, like, especially, you know, I was watching this like literally during a local protest of police violence. And so, like, I was like, oh, yeah, this story is anti-racist. Like, that's why Dr. Seuss wrote this to like atone for his own racism. And the movie doesn't care about that. Like, they don't engage with any of those ideas. I don't know how you guys felt.
I felt like it was kind of breezed by, like, and I felt like there were two camps in this film. So it's like in Whoville, there was like a whisper of like racism ish sort of like happening. But I felt like on Horton's end, it was more about God and religion.
So that's the other backstory piece that I wanted to get into. I don't know if you are aware that the anti-abortion movement like adopted a person's a person, no matter how small.
Sorry. Did that give away my feelings? Well, sorry.
I think that it's useful for you to have feelings about that. And Dr. Seuss's widow was like, please stop doing this. that's not what he was writing about. I got extra nervous because I was like, oh, I'm going to go look at Cinco Paul's Wikipedia page. And it turns out he is Mormon. And I don't know if he's still, or he grew up Mormon, I should say, and is still Christian in some capacity, such that he and Ken Daria are writing a musical called AD 16 about teenage Jesus and Mary Magdalene.
It's like Riverdale, but horrible in every way.
So I got really nervous also that this was going to end up being very Christian, and not like, I am not anti-Christian. Like, I'm not Christian, but like in the grand scheme of things, I think that it's net positive. But I got nervous. But I also don't really, I didn't see it as that. So you did see the Christian undertones?
Yes. And not even necessarily Christian, just more about believing in something, in a higher power, something.
Faith.
Right. Having faith in something more. With my own personal background and my own stance on in life and everything, I just it's shown as God to me.
Yeah.
And just, you know, with the kangaroo, and I was like, you know, and I kind of had it like when she starts talking about, oh, what about the children? And you don't talk this nonsense to the children. Specifically, I started to think about prayer in school and how people are anti-prayer in school and, you know, and all that thing. So, yeah, that's kind of where my head went for Horton's end.
That is a good point. I definitely got Karen vibes off of.
I actually call her Kangaroo Karen in my notes.
I also have Kanga Karen in my notes.
and like the don't bother the children with big ideas, like we're seeing that play out
right
a lot.
I think that the upshot of this conversation is it's just mixed and muddy what they're saying because, right, as Robin points out, they're probably trying to say nothing. They're probably trying to take this, you know, fairly loaded and confessional work, at least as far as Dr. Seuss books go, and turn it into, you know, kind of a watered down version of that. If you like, the proof for me was that when we get down to Whoville, the mayor is simultaneously science and religion in a weird way. Like, he's the one like presenting expert information on what's going on around them, but then has that speech where he's like, there's a talking elephant in the sky, which is clearly like a religion riff. Like, I think that, you know, they perhaps against, you know, whatever they wanted to do as screenwriters, got the directive like, yeah, just make this a nice, pleasant, plucky kid's story and leave it at that.
Yeah, maybe it's just us as adults trying to find some meaning in it all. Why it exists? Why are there 83 minutes of this thing or however long?
Well, midway, I was like, this is a coronavirus metaphor because the mayor is like, there's a public health emergency. We need to go inside. And the board of directors is like, no, we have a celebration planned. We're not canceling that.
Oh, yeah, right.
Yeah. Yeah, mm-hmm. Exactly. So, yeah. So I guess it's just where your head is.
Yeah, we are mapping so much onto this right now.
I don't know if we were to have Dr. Seuss himself here right now, he'd just be like, I don't know. I thought it was cute that somebody that there'd be something living on a speck of something.
An elephant's big and the speck small. It's adorable.
He is on record saying that he wrote this about specifically confronting his own anti-Japanese racism during the war.
Yeah, that's not in the movie.
I mean, I don't really think that should be in the movie in 2008, but I think that you could like wrestle with that a little bit more. I think that we've kind of summed it up. It's trying to say something. It doesn't know what. It ends up saying nothing, but it's cute.
Right.
But it should have stayed like the little 24-minute TV special. It didn't need to be stretched out.
Or well, add more? Flesh it out. Why? Right. Why not? One thing I think they might have added was like the turmoil because the spec keeps being imperiled. Like the like,
save the cat.
It's suddenly dark now. We've got tornadoes. I don't remember that in the book. Was that in the TV special?
Yeah, they when the bird drops it into the field of very similar clovers, like the town has kind of fallen over.
Okay.
Well, speaking of whether or not it needed to exist, let's look at the Factsy segment to see if anyone cared. And turns out they kind of did. Horton Hears a Who was released March 14th, 2008. It was the 11th number one film of that year, winning its first weekend with $45 million. Two completely forgotten new releases were also in the top 10 that weekend. The Karate Kid knockoff Never Back Down with Amber Heard. Anybody?
I saw it. My friend Regina was working at the Oaks Theater at the time. Oh, and yeah, we would sometimes do midnight screenings just for us.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
And that was one that we did. And frankly, it was delightful, possibly only because of the context of watching it that way.
Right.
Right.
It opened in third place with $8.6 million. Sci-fi action flick Doomsday opened in seventh with $4.9 million. Somehow, Horton Hears a Who repeated at number one the following weekend, holding off three debuting films. Tyler Perry's Meet the Browns was in second with $20 million. Supernatural horror flick Shudder. Not Shudder, Shutter, like Shutter Island without the second word. Shutter was in third with $10.4 million. And Owen Wilson in notorious flop Drillbit Taylor opened in fourth with $10.3 million, all fell to Horton, who earned $24.5 million for that second weekend. Finally fell to second place in the third weekend behind the blackjack drama 21. It did hold on well, 7 weeks in the top 10, and a total of $154.5 million. Surprisingly, just barely a top 10 movie that year. It was the 10th highest grossing film of 2008, just a few million dollars behind Quantum of Solace. Number one for the year, of course, was The Dark Knight with $533 million. There have been five theatrical feature-length Dr. Seuss movies. The first two were the creepy live-action ones, then they switched to computer animation. There are two major shocking facts coming. One is every Dr. Seuss movie is a number one movie in America. Wouldn't have guessed that. But the bigger shock, this continues to blow my mind. The first live action, or the first feature-length Dr. Seuss movie, was How the Grinch Stole Christmas with Jim Carrey. That was a four-week number one movie in America in 2000. We mentioned it a few weeks ago because it kept Unbreakable from becoming a number one movie in America. How the Grinch Stole Christmas earned $260 million. I never would have guessed this. How the Grinch Stole Christmas is the number one movie of the year 2000.
I wouldn't have guessed that either. I knew it was a big hit. Yeah, I knew it was a big hit, but I definitely didn't think it was that big of a hit.
I looked at it, and then I looked at it again for a while, because it didn't make, like, 98 is Titanic, 99 is Phantom Menace, 2001 is Harry Potter 1. All of that makes sense.
Right.
And the year 2000...
That's insane.
How the Grinch Stole Christmas is number one with $260 million. Then Castaway, Mission Impossible 2, Gladiator, X-Men is eighth, Meet the Parents is seventh.
Wait,
the first
Castaway
scary movie.
Is two?
Yep, $233 million.
Wow. I mean, I saw that in the theater, but wow.
Weird year. Yeah, I had no idea. All the rest also number one movies in America. The Cat in the Hat, a 1.5 week number one movie in America, depends on how you count the Thanksgiving weekend, in 2003. $101 million, 28th overall for the year. Horton Hears a Who was next in 2008. The Lorax came out in 2012, won 2 weekends, $214 million, 11th overall for that year. And The Grinch, the computer animated version with Benedict Cumberbatch in the title role, a 1 week number one movie in America in 2018. Also a top 10 movie that year, $270 million, seventh overall. The special mentioned, Horton Hears a Who, aired on CBS on March 19th, 1970, did well enough, but did not become, you know, a cultural touchstone the way that some of the others have. The book was released in 1954. And by the way, the musical, Seussical, is also basically Horton Hears a Who. Most of the other major doctors show up, but the core story of Seussical is Horton Hears a Who. It was actually a bomb. It ran for fewer than 200 performances amid terrible reviews. It lost $11 million all told, although it is slowly making that money back because it's a very popular choice for high school performances and you know, theater schools to do. Even with little kids, you can kind of pull off one of the abbreviated versions, but did not do well on Broadway. So those are the facts. Again, the shocking thing here, Dr. Seuss movies are apparently a guaranteed really big hit, and I had no idea.
You know, it makes sense to me because there are multiple generations who adore Dr. Seuss, and so you've got the parents taking the kids, you've got the grandparents taking the kids.
Yeah, I mean, clearly it's been around since, like, the books have been out since at least the 50s. Right. Yeah. And I mean, I recall that being a lot in heavy rotation at my bedtimes and stories that my mom read and stuff. And there's like one that always carries over for me, like Fox and Socks is the big one that I have always liked. And I've had like three people give me that book in an adulthood. and so it's like it's just one of those things. It's a super fun thing. So, yeah, I guess I can see why people I haven't seen any of the live action.
Me neither.
Grinch.
I watched the first 20 minutes of the live action Grinch and was like, this is unwatchably bad. And also, I remember at the time Jim Carrey talking about how much the contact lenses hurt. And that it was like, he like literally said, he was like, this was like torture. He's like, when I think about torture, I think about wearing those contact lenses. Okay. And so I could only think about that.
I can see that. Yeah. I just stand by the 25 minute animated version. that's right. Where I live, right there.
Well, and the stuff in Horton's Jungle was definitely more fun. Like, my only legit LOL was at the monkey shoving bananas in his mouth like a million cigarettes until one comes out his nose.
And that was gross.
Maybe because, you know, Jim Carrey was clearly having fun with it. It's basically Ace Ventura 3. Like, everything up there is pretty fun. So, of course, the movie spends way more time in Whoville. On this, like, complete nothing, like, oh, the mayor's son is a weird goth who doesn't want to, but he's secretly into sound instruments. I, like, that was the biggest stretch, and it did nothing.
Right. I didn't understand why we went through, I thought his little noise machine was going to be the thing that saved the day, but it wasn't. So why did we have to go there?
Daddy issues.
Like 75% of our films that we've reviewed could just like be boiled down daddy issues.
That's, you should put that on the next bingo card if we ever get another bingo. Right?
Is Steve Carell good at voice acting? Like, he's really bland here. And yes, then you think about the Despicable Me series where, like,
same writers
are they that yeah, I mean, like, Gru is goofy acting with a specific accent. Steve Carell is great. I don't know if animation is his, if voice work is his thing.
I'd tell you who gets the prize. It's Will Arnett as Vlad the Vulture.
That was enjoyable. I was definitely into Vlad the Vulture and his wandering accent.
Yes. Then, oh no, here come the water slides.
Honestly, I am such a laugh slut for broken idioms. I blame Perfect Strangers. It is 1000% Perfect Strangers' fault, but I will always laugh at that.
Yeah.
I love that Carol Burnett is getting work, but, like, you brought her in to be, like, the unfunny killjoy. Like,
also thought about that, like, Carol Burnett, I adore her, and why would you, maybe she like really wanted to do it, is that possible? And they were like, here's the role. Similarly, Amy Poehler is completely wasted as shrill sideline wife.
I mean, that's
the worst. She was Oh, that sucks.
You know, like, I remember Seth Rogen being Horton's friend Morton, but, like, I don't remember what that character added to it. Apparently Jonah Hill was in it. I don't remember him at all.
He and Dan Fogler. Tommy?
Pre-fame Dan Fogler. I mean, fame, you know, Fantastic Beasts. But pre...
Our knowing who he is.
Right.
Pre-wizard Dan Fogler is the main councilman. Like, Isla Fisher is that doctor for two scenes. Jamie Presley allegedly is... Isla. Jamie Presley allegedly is in this movie.
I think so. Like, they can't pronounce anything right.
Oh.
En Vogue. En. Okay. En. My brain still says on. You could have made it more interesting, and you had all of the cast you needed to make it, like, funny and whimsical, and it is for, like, the first 20 minutes, and then they just kind of like, all right, we got you in, now let's just get through to the end.
Right. I think, in my opinion, or what I might think, my very limited knowledge of what goes on making animated films, is that, you know, I think a lot of the other ones, a lot of other animated films, they allow their actors more room to, like, kind of, you know, just kind of riff off of each other and that kind of stuff. And maybe they were a little more structured with this one and they just didn't allow them to stretch their own comedic chops, because there's a lot of stuff that you hear and you'll see, like, the bloopers in there. And, you know, they went through, like, you know, 10, 20 different takes of a joke that really sold it. And so, yeah, maybe that was the case.
I definitely missed, as much as I think that Dr. Seuss movies, it makes more sense to make them animated, I missed Jim Carrey's physical comedy. Like, watching a cartoon elephant, like, tumble over himself to keep a speck safe, like, was mildly amusing, but I wanted to watch Jim Carrey do it.
Yeah.
It's possible that 2008 Jim Carrey would not, I'm thinking of, you know, 1994
Fire Marshal Bill
Yeah. So it's possible he wouldn't have totally been up to the task. But I don't know. I didn't see Sonic the Hedgehog.
That said, all of the ears as different kind of hats gags were great. That worked.
Yeah, that was cute.
No, it was like the direction was playful and it was imaginative for a while. And then this is the, I mean, I kind of feel this way about this recent run, because now I've seen all three of these. The Grinch, like, what I remember it being fine, but like after a half an hour being like, oh, I'm half watching this while I'm on my phone. I know I saw The Lorax in theaters and like it had some good musical numbers and again a good voice cast, but I don't really remember. This is how memorable it is. I way more remember that when The Lorax came out, AMC did one of those, a character from a popular thing explains movie theater rules, pre-show videos with The Lorax. And every time I saw it, which because of my life was like 50 times, I was like, I don't think The Lorax goes to the movies. I don't. He speaks for the trees. I don't think he lines up to go to an AMC movie theater.
Probably but, saw The Happening.
Yes. Don't. Now Tony's going to make us watch The Happening.
Please no. I still have a veto in pocket.
Yes, that's right. They're fine. Like, I'm going to give this an above average score. They're fine. They're pleasant. It's nice that if you had a three-year-old, you'd think, yeah, I can probably take them to see this. They're leaving a lot of like humor and whimsy on the table. That's the first time I've ever said someone left whimsy on the table. but there's nothing wrong with these, I guess.
It's fine.
I definitely appreciated this being 80 minutes long.
Yeah.
And free on Hulu. That was a big
deal. Yeah. That was
really
big...
helped out.
My Hulu is confused now.
Well, like, luckily, I have a profile for Kaj, and that's where I watched it under.
Should make up... like a Nomia profile.
Right.
The Up Next was like a My Little Pony special, and I'm like, no, it's no.
No. This is where it stops, Hulu. Thank you. The fun thing is, what I used to, when I was watching this, I was reminded that when I was little, probably like 7 or 8, I used to pretend like we were small. Again, not ever having heard the Horton and the Who thing, I used to pretend that we were toys. The Earth, like everybody on Earth were toys being manipulated by giants. Like we were these small things to something else.
The Simpsons episode where Lisa discovers a society on her tooth, which is inspired by a Twilight Zone episode, which I'm not sure I've ever seen. That put that idea in my head when I was little and definitely, you know, kaboom, my brain.
Yeah. And I used to also like, I was also around born in the time where there were still 8-track players in the house and 8-tracks were still being used. And I remember looking inside of it and, you know, not understanding music and pretending or at least thinking that the little musicians would be in there playing the music. And when you look inside the 8-track, you see like all the little gears and stuff. And some of that stuff looked like instruments to me, like drums and keyboards.
That is adorable. Also, I have no idea what the inside of an 8-track looks like. I don't think I've ever seen an 8-track in real life.
Oh, wow.
And I'm not that much younger than you. It's just like it had a limited era.
Right. Cause like, I think it was like right on the cusp was like when I was born. So like probably like before I was like 6 or 7, it was like gone. You know, we were all into vinyl at that point. It was all vinyl and cassettes.
I have a couple here somewhere. I've never owned an 8-track player. Maybe it's like Abbey Road and The Doors' Greatest Hits. And like, they just ended up with my stuff, my CDs and stuff at one point. And every time I move, I'm like, I'm not getting rid of that. So,
no, I mean, if anything, it makes a lovely conversation piece.
Mm-hmm.
I still have some cassettes.
Oh, me too.
I won't get rid of CDs. I finally got rid of VHS tapes because I was like, it's not going to happen. But CDs just feels like my entire teenage years, I lived and died on the size of this collection. I can't let it go.
Yeah, exactly. I at least did though, like put them all in like one of those CD cases. So like I don't have to take up as much room and they're like tucked away somewhere. I very rarely pull out an actual CD. It's hard to just toss them away. But I did keep a lot of my mixtapes, my actual mixtapes, because...
Nice.
Worked hard on those.
Made them on cassettes, like that was a labor of love.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And I used to like make the covers too. I would cut out ads from like the magazines and like put them on there. It was a whole process, man.
I would make the covers for my mix CDs. I made mixtapes for a little while, but quickly mix CDs became an option. Mm-hmm. And I would make the covers like in Paint Shop Pro and print them out and put them in CD cases.
Mm-hmm. Kids these days with your Spotify playlists.
They'd barely even have to buy music anymore, let alone like know the labor of actually like going to pick stuff out and timing it just right, or figuring out, making that decision, do I play, let this song play out and cut off, or do I leave dead space at the end of the side of the tape?
Also, it was thrilling when I got a CD, what did we even call it when it was a CD that recorded?
A CDR?
CDR, I think what it was. I got a CDR software that let me do crossfading, and it was like, ooh. I was like, I am the coolest mixtape maker
shit
in Governor Livingston Regional High School.
I still have some. This is one that I still have. Like, I found super primitive, like, sound editing software. This is probably in about 2000. And I downloaded a bunch of, you know, creepy songs, like the Killer Clowns from Outer Space theme, and that the one System of a Down song on the first album that's really down tempo. And I edited in iconic lines from horror movies. Ooh. Into the dead parts of the songs.
Nice.
And I was like, now music production is a hobby. Didn't really go anywhere. But I'm doing a podcast, so hey.
I do think that set me up to be capable to edit podcasts. So,
right.
Yeah, I know what a sound wave looks like. I would like to point out that we have had like a nearly 10-minute aside about dead physical media, because there's so little to say about Horton Hears a Who.
How did we even get here?
You said you imagined a little band living in your 8-track cassettes or whatever you call it.
Yes, exactly. Yes, exactly. We've gone through the whole, basically, the family tree of musical.
I think that means it's time to rate Horton Hears a Who. Yeah. With a thorough shrug, 60? 60. Well, you know, it's above average and fine. Camila?
63.
55.
Robin, how do you justify this tiny, tiny difference?
I think the missed opportunities, and I don't know if I would feel this way if I were watching it at another less fraught time, but I guess that I wanted there to be a message that there wasn't.
No, that's entirely valid. Leaves us with 59 and a third, seems right. That is sandwiched in between Jagged Edge and Pain and Gain. This here's a sentence that no one in the history of humanity has ever said before. Horton Hears a Who is a little better than Pain and Gain. That's what we're here to determine. It's pretty low for our evaluation of animated movies. It is our second lowest animated movie, ahead of only Ants. So
it's fucking boring.
Yeah. That's the issue. So the bingo card, did anything happen?
Oh yeah, man, this is a good one. So characters do break into song.
Yes.
It was free on Hulu.
Yes.
And I would, is it a remake this time?
I don't think so, because the previous one was a TV special.
Okay.
So same logic as Fugitive.
Well, friends, I would like to say bingo.
Ooh, that's a bingo.
Woo!
With the second ever number one movie in America, bingo. I'm not bitter at all. It's fine. If at any point the ratings had been more than 30 apart, we got a DVD that I owned, or last week we had decided that whatever we watched last week, I forgot it again.
Toy Story 4
was a comedy. No, congratulations to Camila Adams, who has our second bingo and now has a second veto. If history is any indication, she's going to have it for about 20 minutes.
Right. Yay.
To celebrate your achievement, one, I guess, make the next bingo card, because
yeah,
you're
right. Gonna... right.
But also, speaking of games, Camila, tell everyone about number one movie in America trivia. If you're listening to this the day it drops, tomorrow night.
Thanks, Sean. Well, tomorrow night, we will be experiencing some online movie trivia. And I didn't know I was going to be doing this, so I don't have the information in front of me. So go to our Facebook page, Number One Movie in America. We have an event up there. And if you RSVP, yes, I'm going to go to this thing, we will go ahead and email you the Zoom link the day of the event. And there'll be prizes. We're going to be doing movie trivia off of the 5 movies that we rated the highest. And those movies are Speed, Ocean's 11, obviously the 2000, the Brad Pitt version.
Toy Story 4.
Crimson Tide. So we'll be doing trivia for those. And there's a $25 gift card to Grubhub to the winner. So just join us online, please, to do some movie trivia. You know, stretch your film nerd legs, so to speak, and get out there and just play some games and win some like $25 to spend on your food to come be delivered at your door. You don't have to talk to anybody or see anybody.
That makes a time for You Can't Handle the Truth. Who wants to go first? Because I'm gonna derail things, let me tell you.
I have to look up and see if I did see anything this weekend.
Robin?
I mostly saw me scrolling through HBO Max and getting excited about things I'm going to watch. I did watch a few things on there. So, like, if you want my hot takes of the private life of Henry VIII, I got them. Surprisingly really good is the answer. Yeah, I am so excited about watching all the old movies that are on there because, you know, famously the problem with streaming services is that all of the movies are from 1980 forward, kind of like our podcast.
Right.
And I love old movies. And so it's really great to watch old movies. I fell asleep to Casablanca last night without having to pull out my DVD and very happy about it.
I have yet to dive in because of the Roku problem.
I also have the Roku problem on my good TV, which is frustrating. Are they going to fix that?
They're just arguing over the Roku wants more money.
Okay.
But I think they're going to bend because they're really getting hammered. Both sides are really getting hammered.
Right.
So they're going to cut a deal. But
okay, good.
Yeah, I'm pumped to get started on it. And since pandemic began, I've been telling Mary Beth, like, we can't only watch movies. Like, you just have to pick something that's a half an hour long. So if we're just sitting down to lunch or whatever, we can throw something on. HBO Max happened and she said, good news, we're watching Friends from the beginning. So...
That's all right.
Get ready to cringe.
Yeah,
no, I can't laugh a lot. Like that show, I don't know. The youths don't think it's
problematic.
Funny. Yeah, yeah. I'm in the category of I will laugh so hard and then I will go, oh.
Most things.
I paid the little $19.99 to watch High Note.
Cool.
I would like that back.
I thought the trailers looked good.
Listen, I feel like it was a bait and switch. I went in thinking that this was going to be a Tracy Ellis Ross led film. It was not. It's all about little Miss Dakota. What's her butt?
Wait, seriously?
Yes. Like Tracy is like literally in the film, probably like 17 minutes. Like Ice Cube is like probably in there for like 5. It's just
that
like
is not what the trailer suggests.
Thank you. Yes. It just all becomes like this whole thing about it's kind of just like a hidden white savior movie where Dakota comes in and she saves Tracy's career. And then she helps this other young black R&B singer come in, you know, and up and coming. And I couldn't even finish watching it. I kept trying to make myself finish it because I paid $20 for it. But right. At some point I was like, you know what? Fine. You can just have it. Just Tracy, you can get all that. I would like to publicly announce that I would like all my $19.99 to go to Tracy Ellis Ross. For this film.
Did you get to the dumb twist at the end?
No. What was that? Spoiler. What was that?
Spoilers for the High Note, which this is a good time to spoil because maybe it'll discourage someone from buying it. The Tracy Ellis Ross is the young guy's mother.
Stop it.
Uh-huh.
No.
Did
you guys see Second Act with J-Lo?
No.
Yes.
Same deal. Same deal where it was like, this is weirdly an adoption movie?
Right.
Dakota Johnson.
I watched it the same day that we were on our way bringing Kaj back from Florida. Like I watched it in a hotel and I was like, what?
I didn't expect these kind of feelings.
Dakota Johnson is mentoring, like, this guy that is a gifted singer and totally rich, but doesn't care about advancing his career secretly, because she's supposed to be Tracy Ellis Ross's assistant all the time, so she has to keep it a secret. And then when they're all finally in the same place, he's like, oh, hey, mom.
Womp, womp, womp. Yeah, it's... I was not pleased by the whole thing. Like, it's literally, it's a bait and switch. Because it's just like, you go in thinking that this is going to be a Tracy-led film, and it's not. It's so not.
Thank you for the warning.
Everything in it, you know, the music is good. It's like an honest try of a bad thing. But every moment they actually have something to say, or it's interesting, involves the Tracy Ellis Ross character. Mm-hmm. And so, but we spend the entire time with like a watered down version of Anna Kendrick's character from Pitch Perfect.
Yes. Like, who was already the worst.
Right. Exactly. Yeah, like we spend a lot of time, like, and you know what? I really am trying hard not to put Dakota on my list of up celebrities I want to fight, but she's making it really rough. And, you know, like, it's just the way that she delivers her lines and, like, her, you know, the so-called joking, and there's a lot of little mumbling. And it's just real annoying to me. And I just, yeah, I was bitter.
I always want to defend her, but I can't right now.
I mean, you know, it's not, she didn't write the movie. She's so, she can't be judged too harshly. But yeah.
I do have a deep conditioner from Tracy Ellis Ross's hairline coming in the mail to me.
Well, which if anybody will advocate on a deep conditioner, that's Tracy Ellis Ross. I'm like, yes, she knows what she's talking about.
Right. Her hair is perfect. She has
glorious fucking mane.
So Robin did a better job of getting the money directly to Tracy Ellis Ross.
Yes, exactly.
I feel like Ulta probably took too much out of it, but
right.
I'll report back.
So Jean, what is your derailment?
I almost accidentally watched two Jean-Claude Van Damme movies in the last week.
Did you trip? What do you mean?
No, it was never really an active choice. Like, the 2 weeks ago on DVE, we were talking about The Last Dance a little bit. Somehow the Jean-Claude Van Damme, Dennis Rodman feature double team came up. And Bill Crawford said, oh, that's the worst movie I've ever seen. And I said, oh, well, now I'm watching it. Because it's definitely in the so bad it's good territory. My favorite thing about it is Dennis Rodman, because he's Dennis Rodman, is constantly making basketball references. He's constantly making little quips, like, you know, for at some point they have to get out of a plane. I don't know why or where they were going, but there's a skydiving scene, and they argue. They're like, Dennis Rodman's like, this is gonna work. And Jean-Claude is like, what, why don't we have parachutes on? And Dennis Rodman's like, it's gonna work, trust me. And they jump out of the plane, and then they hold hands, and then a giant inflatable basketball envelops them, and they go and bounce gently to the ground.
What is this movie?
Is it streaming somewhere?
Is Dennis Rodman at least supposed to be a basketball player?
That's the thing. No. He's a Belgian arms dealer named Yaz. And every 3 minutes, he's like, I got to get off the bench. And it's like, why not just make him Dennis Rodman? That would be fine.
I am watching this immediately.
It's free on Pluto TV. Okay. The problem is, you know what it's a lot like? It reminded me of Reindeer Games. It reminded me of Reindeer Games, where it's like, instead of being like, this movie is ridiculous, it has that like, this is cool and tough and serious. Yes. And it's, no, you just fell from the sky in a basketball. This isn't a serious movie.
Your cast is Dennis Rodman and Jean-Claude Van Damme.
Right. And you need to take a long, hard look in the mirror.
Mickey Rourke is the bad guy.
And Mickey Rourke in like his fallow period.
Right.
This, like, what year is this? Is it the 90s?
97, I think.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
But then I found the one where everything works, because on Saturday I drove to the drive-in, a drive-in near us, the Riverside Drive-in in Armstrong County, Pennsylvania, which is great. Mm-hmm. Last weekend they did a hockey double feature of Sudden Death and Slapshot.
Oh, wow.
Sudden Death. Now that's the one where it works, because for an hour, you're like, it's every Jean-Claude movie. And then he fights the mascot. Then he has a serious JCVD fight scene with a 7-foot penguin. And we're like, I think they know it's funny this time. And then half an hour later, for no reason that I understood, he briefly has to enter the hockey game at goalie. And I'm like, yes, this is the one that understands.
To get access to the bomb.
Is right? it?
I think I haven't seen this movie in a long time.
No, there are many. I think that, like, he had been going around defusing bombs, and then guys were onto him. And to disguise himself, he put on a goalie's costume because you can't even see the face. And then, for reasons, he ended up on the bench, and the coach was like, get in there. And there's a whole 5 minutes of this movie where he's in a goal, and he gives his, like, I love you hand signal to his kid in the crowd. It's great. It's fantastic.
I will say, that is a movie that I genuinely don't know if it is good if you don't love Pittsburgh. Like, I give it so much goodwill out of loving Pittsburgh. So... non-Pittsburghers, if you think that Sudden Death is a camp classic, sound off on Twitter.
Mm-hmm. Should we draw a movie?
We should.
Yes.
Now that there are two vetoes in play.
Did you light the candles on the altar?
Tony Goldman.
I know.
The number is 91. We've gone to the other end of the alphabet, and a film number 91 is the 80s comedy Back to School.
Tight.
That seems right.
Rodney Dangerfield, right?
Yeah. I had to double check because there's a lot of, like, academically themed comedies from around the time. But yeah, Rodney Dangerfield in Back to School.
I've never seen a Rodney Dangerfield film in its entirety.
Caddyshack?
I don't know if I've ever watched Caddyshack start to finish.
I think it was at Row House. I'm going to assume for Father's Day weekend.
Right.
and I went, and that's another one where I'm like, yeah, it's fine. It has some laughs. I think it was more for the time. But I'm pumped to spend the first of how many, like, we've been on either vampires or children's films for long enough. Rodney Dangerfield seems like the antidote to that.
It absolutely is. It's like the scene, and I don't know if you recall it, but in Go, where they, like, the couple does something that's, like, too wholesome, and then he's like, I need to go bathe myself in sin after that. That's kind of... This is what Rodney Dangerfield is. This is what Back to School is.
Although, isn't that a slice of the pandemic that, like, a mild 80s comedy feels like bathing ourselves in sin? Right. We haven't had good vices in a while. Anyway, no, I'm good. I'm happy. Yes.
Let's do it.
This is where I was waiting for Robin to surprise veto for a reason we had never considered.
No, I watched that movie a ton as a kid. I'm excited to watch it as an adult.
I'm always happy to go back to the 80s. So
also that.
Horton Hears a Who, which may have had an exclamation point. I can't tell anymore. Was released March 14th, 2008. What was the number one song in America that weekend?
Coldplay?
I mean, how many hit singles did they have?
They had that one, which was around 2008. Like, Viva La Vida.
Vida Loca, but not.
you're within weeks of it. Viva La Vida. Well, within a couple of months. Yeah, that was a number one later that summer. That was the thing when they were playing the Super Bowl. It's like, oh, great, they can play all their hits. Like, yeah.
Was it the Jason Derulo, What You Say?
No, Jason Derulo was a few years later, because I remember running to Jason Derulo, and I did not run. I ran for the first time in my life in, like, 2011. So
Kanye?
Kanye did not have a number one that year. This is a 3-week winner by an R&B artist.
Neo?
No.
Chris Brown? You know,
Neo and Chris Brown and this artist could pretty much switch back catalogs and no one would really notice. That's not fair.
This artist
is better than Neo Brown. Yes, correct. With?
Oh my God.
No, I think that's Love in This Club.
Ooh, what a good song. I already love that song, and then Hustlers happened, and it is it's like the best music movie moment of last year for sure.
Truth.
I forgot to give that hint. I was going to say this artist appeared in a movie from last year, because that would have thrown everyone off the scent. Because
that's true.
Mm-hmm.
That would have taken me a long time.
I remember having Usher singles when I was 13. See, speaking of dead media, CD singles.
Oh my God, I almost forgot about those.
I had a bunch of those.
I remember getting Usher singles and being like, I don't think this is appropriate for me. This is too sexy.
Well, what?
Like, there's lots of songs that are sexy, but in an Usher single, the sex is like right there. I broke Camila, so I guess that's how the episode ends.